Doctrine of the Trinity, the second talk in a series entitled Biblical Philosophy, the Message and Worldview of the Bible, was presented by Jack Crabtree on October 23, 2011 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2011. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, we're going to begin this series of discussing what I have given you. I've given it you on the internet if you had access to it. You can go to the McKinsey Study Center website. You'll find this as a PDF attachment to last week's talk, the Ordinary Christian's Creed. It won't be critical that you have that today, but this is going to form the basis of my discussion. This is a completely artificial creed, and the critical thing to understand is this is not what I believe the Bible teaches. This is not what I believe authentic and true Christianity is, but I think this is a fair representation of what many Christians believe. You might have to find two Christians and mush their beliefs together to come up with this creed. You may not have one Christian who believes exactly this and only this. I'm not pretending that it's a realistic creed held by anyone in particular, but I think it's representative of a kind of picture of the faith that the typical Christian probably has. For those of you who have read it, let me just make one brief comment before we dive into some details. If you read it and tried to digest it at all, one thing that will probably be really striking to you is the thing that was striking to me is there ain't no room for Jews in here. I mean, the only, in this picture of our faith, the purpose of Judaism was to somehow give Genesis to Jesus the Messiah. And once he's on the scene, to be the savior of mankind, to die for the sins of the world, and put in place God's provision for salvation, you know, what's the good of being a Jew after that? There really isn't any place for that. And that should be a striking kind of, that should strike us, because that is so contrary to the picture that you get in the Bible. So there's got to be something wrong if my very digestion of the message of the Bible and the worldview of the Bible doesn't have the same implications as the worldview of the Bible. So those are the kinds of things that should be telltale signs to us that we're somehow off track when those don't match. But take a look at it and see if that isn't a striking, a noteworthy thing about this creed. Now, what I'm maintaining is that there are basically 25 assertions in this creed. What I'm maintaining, rather boldly, is that Jesus would not embrace a single one of them. Every one of these 25 assertions has something fundamentally wrong with it, such that it doesn't really conform to what Jesus believes, what Jesus would teach, what Jesus would embrace. And it's in that sense that my subtitle for this series, Why Jesus Would Not Be a Christian, that's what I mean by that. It's this Christianity that Jesus would not be. So if you have another conception of Christianity that actually conforms to what the Bible teaches, Jesus would embrace that Christianity. And I'm not denying that. Of course Jesus would be a follower of Jesus. Of course Jesus would believe what Jesus teaches. Obviously, true. But that's not what most of us who grew up in Christian culture and absorbed the tenets of Christian culture, that's not really what we believe or have believed. And I think this comes closer to capturing what most of us have believed than what the Bible, what Jesus actually taught. Now, I'm going to take on just one issue today. I don't think we'll have any more time than that. And it's in the very first statement of the creed. From the beginning of created reality, there was God, an eternally triune being. I'm going to read the second one too. From nothing, God gave existence to everything that makes up the cosmos so that the cosmos could now exist right alongside himself. Now, of the two, I'm going to maintain that the mistake in the second one is far more consequential and far, far more far-reaching than the mistake in the first one. But even though the first one is not the most consequential mistake, I think there is, in fact, a mistake in that first assertion, namely the idea that God is an eternally triune being. My contention is that Jesus would not believe, did not teach, would not embrace the doctrine of the Trinity. Now, to say that out loud, we have been taught all of our lives that to say that out loud is the province of Satan himself. Satan and only Satan could ever deny out loud the doctrine of the Trinity. But my contention is that we've been bullied and intimidated and enculturated into having a visceral response to that. It's not an intellectual commitment on our part. It doesn't come from real knowledge of what the Bible teaches. It's a sociological reality that you are immediately cast outside the pale, you're immediately marginalized, you're immediately written off as not being spiritually serious if you can deny the Trinity. But let me qualify it, because I know some of you may be having that visceral response, as I would as well. To say that I don't believe in the Trinity does not make me a Mormon, a Jehovah's Witness, a JW, any other kind of weird cult out there. It doesn't make me a modalist. It doesn't make me any sort of a Sabellian necessarily, or any other group that has been branded a heretic in the history of Christianity. We've been told that if you don't believe in the Trinity, then there are a list of options you can choose from, a list of heresies you can choose from, and you identify one or the other of those heresies. And tell me which one you are. But you're not a believer. You're not a follower of Jesus. But that's a false dichotomy. There are other options out there that I would argue have not been explored in the history of Christian thought, in the history of ideas. And that's what I would propose is actually the truth of what the Bible teaches has never really been formulated by any known school of thought that you study in church history. The other thing to be clear on is most people who deny the Trinity, along with that, as a correlate to that, deny the deity of Jesus. I don't think that's right. The deity of Jesus, I think, is clear enough. Jesus may not have ever said, "I am God," in so many words, but it's implicit in everything that he says about himself, I would argue. So, and the apostles pick up on that, and a couple of them say it explicitly. I think John, in the opening chapter of John, when he says, "The Logos became flesh and dwelt among us," that's what he means, is the divine being himself took on, mapped himself onto the personhood of a human being and dwelt among us as Paul would describe him, as the image of the invisible God. So I think it's clear in studying the New Testament that Jesus, the man, is as much God as it makes any sense for a human being to be God. In any and every sense in which that makes sense, Jesus was God in that sense. So I don't think there's any question about the deity of this man, Jesus. But believing in the deity of Jesus does not require that you believe in the eternal Trinity. Okay? The typical Christian believes four things. On the one hand, they at some level believe that the Bible teaches everything that mankind needs to know in order to be saved. On the other hand, they believe that if one does not believe that God is a triune being, that is, if they don't believe in the Trinity, he's definitely not an authentic Christian. And to the extent that you need to be a Christian to be saved, he's probably not saved. There's some room for movement there, but you're not really a Christian if you don't believe in the Trinity, and you may not be saved. They also believe that the Bible, now, At this point, I'm talking about thoughtful Trinitarians, thoughtful Bible students. I don't know about, you know, kind of the run-of-the-mill Christian sitting in the pews, but anybody who's actually examined the Bible in this regard also believes that the Bible never clearly and explicitly teaches that God is a triune being. They know, they acknowledge, they recognize that you will look far and wide to find any evidence in the Bible that anyone in the Bible taught that God is a triune being. What they will always tell you is it is a clear and necessary deduction from the biblical evidence. It's not taught by the Bible, but it is a clear and necessary deduction or inference from the biblical data. But they acknowledge that the Bible never really teaches it. And then fourthly, the Bible never teaches that belief in God as triune is a condition that must be met in order for one to be saved. That couldn't be clearer. Nowhere in the Bible will you find any apostle or Jesus or prophet or anybody saying that you must believe that God is triune lest you die. Only those who believe in the Trinity will be saved. You can find all kinds of evidence that unless you confess Jesus as Lord, unless you confess him as the Christ, you will not be saved, that kind of thing. But along all those statements about how important it is that you believe the truth about Jesus, none of them ever say, unless you believe in the Trinity, you cannot be saved. Notice what an incoherent set of beliefs that is. On the one hand, the Bible gives us everything that mankind needs to know in order to be saved, and no Messiah or prophet or apostle ever got around to telling us the most critical thing of all, that you believe in the Trinity, and yet, yes, that's the most critical thing of all. That's completely incoherent. And the thing that's astonishing to me is that it took me decades to realize how incoherent that was. But it's completely incoherent. You can't believe those four things at the same time, and if you're paying attention, that you just can't do that. So something has to give. Normally, what people do when they're thinking about it is that they challenge that one belief there. The Bible teaches everything that mankind needs to know in order to be saved, and they say, well, maybe not. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe tradition adds some critical essential pieces that are not actually in the Bible, but they are from God, they are from Jesus, through his apostles and some kind of unwritten tradition, and there are critical pieces to our salvation that we need to get through the tradition. Okay, logically that would work, but notice from the outset, if you make that move, that is a stark admission that Christianity is a different religion from the belief system based solely on the Bible. I mean, that's a stark admission that biblical philosophy is different from Christianity if you go that direction. Furthermore, going that direction, I think, is a completely ad hoc and an utterly implausible assumption. Is it really plausible that the apostles in the New Testament really never got around to mentioning the fact that you're going to be damned if you don't believe in the Trinity? When that's the position of Orthodox Christianity, that's entirely implausible to me. And in fact, I would argue that the fact that that's what many of the church fathers maintained is the very thing that makes me suspect of the church fathers. That if they don't even get that right, that if they maintain that an essential aspect of your salvation is your belief in this construct that is only a clear and necessary inference from the biblical data that somebody has put together, and if you don't believe that construct, you are going to hell, you are going to be damned, I don't think they know what they're talking about. Because you put that over against the clear and straightforward and direct teaching of the apostles. What the apostles say makes sense. What they're saying is in conflict with that. That's a different religion. They're not even advocating the same faith. And that's the basis of this series. I don't think they are advocating the same faith. I think they've invented a new religion. This religion that we has come down to us through history as Christianity. And this is just one of the more dramatic ways in which the faith of the Bible and the faith of Christianity are fundamentally different from one another. What's interesting is it's the most dramatic of them, and it's the least consequential. And I say the least consequential because if you do believe God is triune, is that going to mess up your thinking very much? I don't think so. But you know why? I mean, I've spent most of my life thinking that God is triune, and it's arguable whether it messed up my thinking, but I've spent most of my life thinking that. But what did my mind do? Okay, God is three persons in one essence, and what happens to one happens to all of them simultaneously. They're all intermingled without being, they're distinct without being. I'd get so far, and I'd say, how about if I just think it's God? However Trinitarian he may be, I'm just going to think that there's a God there that I have to deal with. Well, I think that's the truth. And so my inability to even comprehend the doctrine of the Trinity, and I would argue I have yet to meet a human being that I'm convinced understands the doctrine of the Trinity. And the reason I don't think that any human being has ever understood the doctrine of the Trinity is because I think it's incomprehensible. I think it's a fundamentally a self-contradictory concept and notion. So none of us can grasp it. None of us ever have. None of us ever will. And faced with the reality of that, what do? We just use that as a placeholder for a basic concept of a Jewish monotheistic God. And so what we really believe is in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the father of Jesus, and so on, which is exactly what we should be thinking. But if anyone challenges us, we say, oh yes, God is one God in three persons. And as long as I don't have to explain what I mean by that, I'm fine. I can put it in my hymns, I can put it in my creeds, I can put it in my doctrinal statements, I can stick it in my pipe and smoke it. I can do all kinds of things with it. But what I can't do is understand it. So I default back into a very real, accurate, true conception of God. So that's why I say I don't think it's consequential, because in the final analysis, we end up believing what we should be believing in spite of ourselves. Not in spite of ourselves, in spite of what tradition and orthodoxy tries to require of us. You have a question?
This is really more of a comment and a little bit of a question. The aspect of Trinity or not Trinity was one thing that was really fought over in the early church fathers. And I just wonder if the fact that a lot of other religions have this Trinity aspect. I mean, Egypt and Babylon and many others I can name. And well, this is one thing that got me questioning it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting point. I haven't researched this a lot and delved into it very much, but it is interesting that three is a sacred number for the Pythagoreans, for example, and that's pretty ancient. So it may be just a coincidence, or it may actually be the influence of certain ancient ideas that the doctrine developed into a three-in-one kind of thing. So I don't know about that. Anything else before I go on here?
Jack, when struggling to comprehend the Trinity, a lot of people like to use analogies. What's your assessment of the analogies? Like people say maybe water, ice.
Well, the problem is when you go to the creed, any analogy you give, the creed contradicts your analogy and says, but whatever it is you're saying there, it's not that. What do any time Christians try to deal seriously with the Trinity, what do they end up being? Tritheists. would be people who believe in three gods, three independent, autonomous gods who have their act together enough that they're working in harmony, but they really are three separate and distinct gods. It's the only way we can conceive of it, to make them three persons be three persons. And yet what the creed is saying is, think of God as three persons, now cut it out. I don't know what to do with that. Okay.
Are they saying three persons is one individual? Is that the contradiction?
You know, the minute I start saying, okay, then it's three persons but one individual, I mean, that, I have a hard time conceiving of that to start with, but okay, whatever persons is, it's not an individual, there's only one individual, and now I start trying to make sense out of the three persons part, and you'll get accused of being a modalist. And we know that's a heresy, because church history declared that to be a heresy. I mean, any way you go, you end up, the minute you start getting clear, you're heretic. So the only way you can avoid heresy is to simply recite the creed verbatim and smile politely. I believe that. That's the only option available to you, because the minute you start being able to get your mind wrapped around it, you fall into some declared heresy that someone has decided is heresy.
You talked about the church fathers some, and said that they didn't really know what they were talking about. Would you say that they had a mostly negative impact on Christian and church history, or were there some positive contributions they made as well?
I think it depends on which church father you're talking about. I think some of them made some tremendous positive contributions. Others of them, not so much. And all of them had some negative contribution to make, because the movement as a whole was going in the wrong direction. And I'll talk about that before I'm done here in my notes. But someone like Augustine, who's a little later, but someone like Augustine is phenomenal for his insight into the existential decisions that we need to make in order to be rightly oriented to God. I mean, he's using a different language that's not our language, but once you translate it into modern terms, the dude's a believer. I mean, he understands exactly what the journey is, what the quest is, what the fight is that we are all engaged in. And I think he can be read with tremendous profit. And then you turn the page and you get some pretty wild stuff that you better ignore. So he does some of each, I think.
You were just saying that, earlier, that there are four, you had four things, everything in the Bible, I can't list them off, but when you were talking about the one that people turn to, I was thinking that of the people I know, I think they would be much more likely to turn and say, it's not necessary for you to believe in the Trinity to be saved, but if you don't, then you have some serious problems with your doctrine and you probably shouldn't be teaching or, you know.
Right.
But, which is kind of it almost feels patronizing, I guess. They maybe pat it on the hand and say, well, you're just really wrong, but, you know, we'll put up with you anyway. But, yeah, what do you do with that?
Well, that's a relatively modern phenomenon. I mean, the fact that I can stand up here and even get this far without being stoned to death is because we're in 2011 and not last century. So it's a relatively modern phenomenon. And then secondly, but even today, to be a part of TRACS, which is a religious organization that accredits colleges, Gutenberg College had to have a doctrinal statement. And in that doctrinal statement, you have to spell out whether or not you believe in the Trinity. Because if you don't spell out whether or not you believe in the Trinity, that will not be an acceptable doctrinal statement to them. So, and go to any church around, they're probably going to have a doctrinal statement. They may not pay any attention to it, but they have a doctrinal statement, and in that doctrinal statement, I almost guarantee you there's something about you have to believe in the Trinity. And if not, you can't be in leadership, you can't teach, there's all kinds of, you're marginalized because nobody knows why. We forgot why. We just know that you're supposed to be marginalized if you don't believe in the Trinity. It was so long ago that we had started this fight. We don't even know why we're fighting it any longer. And frankly, the whole reason for the fight is gone. It was Greeks fighting with each other, and we ain't Greeks any longer. You know, we don't know how to talk like Greeks. We don't know how to think like Greeks. There's no reason to have this fight. And yet, it's got such incredible momentum that the memory of that fight still lingers even today in Christian culture, Christian tradition, Christian institutions. So all I'm saying is, why don't we just study the Bible and figure out what the Bible teaches about who Jesus is and God is and the Spirit of God is and so on. Let's become biblical Trinitarians, not Orthodox Nicene Creed Trinitarians. I mean, why? What is our reason for doing that? Okay? I'm counting on you to ask questions. I can't anticipate all the ways in which I'm being hopelessly unclear. So I need you to ask questions. Don't make any assumptions. Okay, my next point here is if one had never been trained in the doctrine of the Trinity, all of us receive training in how to think about the Trinity of one form or another. Some less sophisticated, some more sophisticated, but we've all received some training. But if we had never been trained in the doctrine of the Trinity and shown how to identify it in the Bible, it would be extremely unlikely that any of us would have ever invented it even as a hypothesis, let alone embrace it simply on the basis of what the Bible says. It is such a unlikely conclusion to draw from the Bible. And hopefully before we're done, I'll explain where I think it came from. But it's not a clear and necessary inference from the biblical data. It's a construct that's been imposed on the biblical data. We've been basically handed this doctrine and told to read the Bible with this in view and find it, see it, recognize it now when you see it. So we have this lens that we're supposed to look at the Bible through. It's the lens of the doctrine of the Trinity. And yes, are you going to find the Trinity if you go to the Bible now? Absolutely. You find it a lot. Every time you see something come in threes, you're going to find it. I mean, you're going to find it, but the question is, are you finding it because it's there in the minds of the biblical authors and the apostles? Or are you finding it there because you're putting it there? And I don't mean that. The fact of the matter is, we are always putting stuff in the text. That's just the way human intelligence works. You wouldn't be an intelligent human being if you didn't put things in a text. We have a set of assumptions. We have a grid that we're working with. We have some kind of worldview or paradigm that we think is true. And we expect to find that true paradigm in whatever it is that we're looking at if we think that is true as well. And that's not wrong to do that. That's perfectly appropriate to do that. But the problem is, it doesn't allow you to simply ever make the argument, I go to the text and it just naturally reads to me like there's a Trinity, therefore there must be a Trinity. Well, of course it naturally reads to you like God is a triune being, because that's the assumption you're bringing to the text, and you're seeing your own assumption reflected back in the way you are interpreting the text. So that makes all the sense in the world. I did that for decades. But it wasn't until the plausibility of the doctrine began to disappear, and passage after passage after passage, when I actually looked at the passage in its context and tried to understand the argument, and it appeared to me what formerly I thought was a text that supported the Trinity is something else entirely different. It's not even talking about that. And, you know, you start off saying there's hundreds of passages that reflect the Trinity. Well, scores. Well, dozens. A couple. And then when you finally end up with two texts left, and then you go to work on those to see what is really going on here. Is this actually teaching the Trinity? And find, lo and behold, I don't think they are either. Then I finally came to the I allowed myself to set those lenses aside and say, I can't read the Bible through these lenses any longer. This just isn't true. This was handed to me. I didn't derive it from the biblical text. It was handed to me, and I've been imposing it on the text for all these decades of reading the Bible. It's not my intention to go to every passage that allegedly teaches the Trinity, at least not now, not yet. If that would be helpful, we can spend a bunch of time doing that, and I'm open to your suggestions in that regard. But the important thing right now is to just realize the nature of the phenomenon, that just because something naturally seems to suggest to you the doctrine of the Trinity, you have to ask yourself the question, but why? Am I already predisposed to see it and to interpret the language that way? Or does the text in its context, in its literary context, actually demand that there's no other explanation for the text?
Jack, could you talk a little bit about how that hypothesis came to be then?
Yes,
if
I
no
will.
One would find it there. Thanks.
Great segue. Sorry. So where does it come from then? It doesn't come from the Bible, and there's no denying this. I mean, anyone who reads the tradition, even if you're a thoroughgoing Trinitarian and you're going to go to the stake for the Trinitarian doctrine, they would agree with me on this. I don't think they would deny this. It doesn't come from the Bible. It comes from the church fathers and church tradition. And by the church fathers, I mean that group of bishops of churches, mostly they were bishops of churches or other leaders in the church, who are beginning to articulate the theology of Christianity post-persecution in the early Roman Empire. So between the time of Jesus and just prior to the time of Constantine, who finally made Christianity legal, you have a group of scholars beginning in a certain amount of peace, with the persecution having stopped, beginning to talk to each other and think about these things. Who are these men? These men are, at this point, exclusively Gentile. They're not Jews. In this time period, whatever Jewish believers were there have been marginalized for the most part. And I would encourage you to go read them. I encourage you strongly to read them directly for yourself. Assess what kind of thinkers are they, what kind of men are they, and what kind of worldview are they operating out of. Because what I would maintain is that these are men who have become fascinated, enamored by the intellectually hip ideas of their day, which happens to be what historians would call Middle Platonism. It derived from Plato, but Plato, as interpreted by a Jewish philosopher out of Alexandria called Philo. Philo was the most influential Middle Platonist on some of the early church fathers in Alexandria, a man named Clement, and a man named Origen. And Philo interpreted the whole Old Testament scripture into sort of Platonic ideas. So the Platonic worldview, and we can talk about that if it becomes important, what that is, but the Platonic worldview, which is not the biblical worldview, it's a pagan, entirely radically different sort of worldview. He reinterpreted the Old Testament scriptures into a kind of Platonic worldview because he loved Plato. He thought Plato was right, and tries to make the case that Moses was just teaching what Plato taught, that's what you have happening in the Old Testament. Well, he left a real significant mark on Clement and Alexandria and other church fathers in Egypt, and through them around the whole Eastern Empire. So, to make a long story short, I think what's happening is Christianity is a syncretistic religion taking elements of that you find in the Bible, combining them with elements that you find in Greek philosophy and, you know, winding them together, intertwining them together into a whole new and different worldview and whole different religion and faith. And the Christianity that was given to us by these church fathers is a synthesis or a syncretism of those two things. The Trinity comes out of that because, in particular, Philo, the Alexandrian Jew, has a very robust concept of the Logos. The Logos was a being that was derived from the ultimate God. He was derived from the ultimate God, but this Logos was inferior to the ultimate God, but it's the Logos who actually created the world, created reality. And somewhere along the lines, some of the church fathers read John 1, where John says, in the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. They looked at that and they said, that's what Philo was talking about. I mean, remember the first time you read John 1? You didn't go, in the beginning was the Logos, second person of the Trinity, I surmise. I mean, you had to be told. There's no way in the world that you would read John 1 and go, you know, I really think he's talking about a separate and distinct person of an eternal Godhead. That's got to be what he's talking about here. I don't think that's where you would have gone. Not without a little nudging from someone. And I mean, one of my earliest memories is reading John 1 going, that doesn't make any sense. Help me with that. Oh, the Logos, the Word. Well, we didn't even use Logos. The Word is the second person of the Trinity. Oh, okay, it's his name. Okay, now I can make sense out of it in the light of that. But I had to be told. It wasn't something that emerged directly and spontaneously and organically from the argument of John 1. I had to be told, and it was interposed on the text. Well, that comes from the fact that there's all these ideas being imported from Middle Platonism into the thought and language and vocabulary and worldviews of the early church fathers. They were thoroughly Greek in their outlook. Now, even apart from that, I mean, I think that's true, but even apart from that, the fact that it comes from the church fathers doesn't really impress me much just in general terms, because where did the institutional church come from? Did it result from it resulted from true believers being pushed out of any position of influence by men who were evil, ambitious, power-hungry, glory-mongering men. And they saw the burgeoning Christian religion as an arena in which to satisfy their lust for power and glory. I mean, you see that already in 3 John. And this is before any of this happens. It's just right under the noses of the apostles themselves, you see something like that happening. Just 3 John very briefly. 3 John, when we went through those, I argued that 1 John was probably a circular that John had written that was sent out to several churches in Asia. 2 John was probably the cover letter for that circular that went out to the churches. That circular and the cover letter got rejected by a certain church in a certain location, and John, in order to get past the gatekeeper who prevented that letter from being read and being circulated and coming in, he writes 3 John as a private letter to somebody else in the church. And it goes something like this. The elder to the beloved Gaius. So he's the private party that he's writing to. The elder to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth. Beloved, I pray that in all respects you may prosper and be in good health, just as your soul prospers. For I was very glad when brethren came and testified to your truth, that is, how you are walking in truth. I have no greater joy than this, to hear of my children walking in the truth. Beloved, you are acting faithfully in whatever you accomplish for the brethren, and especially when they are strangers, and they have testified to your love before the church. So evidently there are emissaries from John who are being sent out to different locations to teach, Gaius is receiving them and is showing them hospitality and giving them physical support of food and lodging and that kind of thing. He's helping them, and John is thanking him for his support for them. They have testified of your love before the church. You will do well to send them on their way in a manner worthy of God. For they went out for the sake of the name, accepting nothing from the Gentiles. Therefore, we ought to support such men so that we may be fellow workers with the truth. I wrote something to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to be first among them, does not accept what we say. So Diotrephes is evidently a person who's risen to a position of power within the church, who's acting like a gatekeeper. John identifies his motive. He loves to be first among them. So here's the lust for glory, for power, for preeminence that begins to raise its ugly head right away within the Christian community. Well, he does not accept what we say. For this reason, if I come, I will call attention to his deeds which he does, unjustly accusing us with wicked words. And not satisfied with this, he himself does not receive the brethren. He does not receive the brethren either, and he forbids those who desire to do so and puts them out of the church. He's literally proactively excommunicating people who show hospitality to these emissaries coming from John. So he's proactively opposing the spread of the apostolic gospel because it doesn't suit his purposes. And the most important thing to him is that he's the most important. That's the most important thing to him. Beloved, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good, and so on. The point I wanted to make is that who are the people who go down in history as the preeminent people within the institutional church? Mostly people like Diotrephes. The people who make history are the people who want to make history. The really, truly faithful, godly followers of Jesus are mostly going to stay under the radar screen of history. We are insignificant. We are inconsequential. We don't really matter. Because it's not our desire to matter in that sense. It's not our desire to be the bishops, to be the pope, to be the rock star preacher or whatever. That's not our ambition. Our ambition is to follow our Lord Jesus, and that doesn't get you a whole lot of glory in this world and in this life. So when we look back to the church fathers, who are these people we're looking back to? Are they the power-hungry, glory-mongering Diotrephes of church history? Or are they the faithful, obedient followers of Jesus of church history? I think it's the former, not the latter. It's a relatively rare person who can be great in the eyes of God simultaneously with being great in the eyes of history. I don't think that person exists very often. Maybe occasionally, but not very often. Well, the church fathers are the people who history has given to us to look up to. The other thing I would say about that, in answer to your question, where did this come from? The vast majority of the men who forged the Christian tradition during the 2nd through 5th centuries, and that's when these doctrines were being formulated. And, you know, and by the way, keep that in mind. The doctrine of the Trinity didn't even exist until at least the third century, beginning in the third century AD, in its incipient forms. And it doesn't get formulated until the fourth century. So we're talking many hundreds of years past the apostles and Jesus' teaching that we even have this doctrine being formulated. And how did it get formulated? By war, assassination, kidnapping, arson, riots, mobs, political intrigue, exile, you name it. They pulled out all the stops. And there was, for a while, what we think of as the doctrine of the Trinity was not in the ascendancy. It was the heresy. And the doctrine espoused by a monk named Arius was actually the one that was being embraced by the emperor and most of the other bishops. But then another emperor came along, it fell out of favor, and now Athanasius, who is the primary author of our creed, that's not true. It's usually the doctrine, the Trinitarian doctrine connected with Athanasius came to the fore again. And it basically is an accident of history that our doctrine of the Trinity that we inherited won the war, won the battle. Now, a Trinitarian would tell you, well, there you go. It won the war because God was overseeing history. Maybe. Yep, that's plausible. God has done a lot of things in a kind of messy way. So you can't discount that right off the bat. But when I put together the way in which the doctrine came into the ascendancy with the fact that it doesn't even get taught in the Bible, it's not even a doctrine that the Bible espouses, that I find it totally implausible to think that we are supposed to embrace this doctrine that came out of an incredibly wicked human process when the Bible, who is the source of our authority, does not even for a second espouse that doctrine or even suggest that doctrine. So what about, let me stop. See if you have any questions.
Can you speak on the formation or the content of the Nicene Creed? Didn't that come about this time you're talking about in the 3rd and 4th centuries?
Yeah, 300 and what? Help me, somebody. 70, 50, 350, 360, 370.
Yeah, and am I wrong that it was kind of like, okay, this is what we're going to agree on. This satisfies the parties and so on. And it's like a compromise, basically, if I understand it.
Well, arguably, the one who called the council was Constantine. And is Constantine a Christian at this time? I don't know. Did he ever become a Christian? I don't know. I mean, a real believer. But so his interest, I think, is primarily political, that this war that's been brewing between the Arians and the Athanasians has been disturbing the empire, and he wants to unite the empire, and this is very inconvenient for him politically. So he calls this council and says, and has all the bishops come, although it's mostly the bishops from the east. The bishops from the west don't show up, a couple of them. And he says, we're gonna figure out what we agree on here. And it has all the appearances of, we are going to figure out something we agree on here. So everybody there signed it, but immediately upon returning home, four of the bishops from Antioch, Jerusalem, a couple of other places, immediately excommunicated all the other bishops who had signed that creed because they had signed that creed. So that strongly suggests to me, even if there wasn't other evidence for it, it strongly suggests to me when they signed it, they were coerced into signing it. They signed it in order to escape with their lives. But they didn't really believe it. They didn't really embrace it. So did I answer your question?
Yeah, it's just when I was growing up I grew up Methodist, and that was extremely important, the Nicene Creed.
Yes. And all of us have been given a sort of mythological view of the Nicene Creed.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it was always presented to me that you had 100 to 200 godly Bible teachers who wanted nothing more than to understand the truth of who God was, who got together, put their heads together, compared notes, and what they all agreed upon together and decided together was this doctrine of the Trinity. And in the earliest draft of the doctrine of the Trinity, not in subsequent drafts, but in the earliest drafts of the Nicene Creed, the earliest drafts of the Nicene Creed consigned people like me to hell for not agreeing with it. I mean, they didn't mince any words. So it was really, really strong. Well, these godly men were just simply comparing notes and together formed this doctrine, which was the inevitable, absolutely essential inference from the biblical data. And they were just they were just being their godly selves in arriving at that inference.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Well, that's simply historically false. That's not what happened. Some of them were assassins. Some of them were engaged in incredibly ungodly and wicked political intrigue. There's no question about that from the historical record. So whatever they were, we have to understand that it's a myth to think that there was nothing happening there except righteousness and godliness and truth in the room, that was the only dynamic at play. That's just false. And besides, we know people, right? I mean, I don't care how many thousands of years ago it was. It's so easy to allow the time past to remove and erase the stains of sin from human beings. But the real people who are really there, really doing this, were just like you and me, and I know that all too well. I know that that doesn't produce good to be like me.
Earlier you mentioned being a biblical Trinitarian rather than a Nicene Creed Trinitarian. Mm-hmm. Could you explain that?
If by the Trinity we mean God is divine, God is God, Jesus is divine, Jesus is God, and the Spirit of God is divine, the Spirit of God is God, yeah, I believe that. I mean, how could I not? So if one wants to call that Trinitarianism, then there's a Trinitarian doctrine that I embrace, that I believe in. Because the Bible does speak about the Spirit of God, does speak about the Son, does speak about the Father, and attributes divinity or deity to all of those three. It's the working out, it's the Nicene construct of what that means that I'm rejecting.
And by divine, you mean, and it's probably a six-week answer, but that's where the real wealth is, right?
Keep going.
I believe that God the Father is divine, the Son is divine, the Spirit is divine. What exactly do you mean by the word divine?
Well, and everyone can agree that God, the Father of all, is God. Is Jesus God? Yes. And what do I mean by that? I mean that he actually is the image of the very person that the transcendent author of all reality is. If you gave Yahweh, God, the transcendent author of all reality, a social security number, Jesus would own that social security number. I mean, he has the very identity, the individual identity of Yahweh himself, reflected in his person. He is divine in a way that you and I never will be divine, never could hope to be. We're made in the image of God, but we are not the image of the invisible God. He is uniquely that, and no one else ever has been or ever will be the image of the invisible God, only Jesus. And the Spirit of God, whenever the Spirit of God is acting in the Bible, it's just God acting. It's a way of describing God entering into his creation and doing something in his creation, showing himself, displaying himself in his creation. So is that God? Well, yeah, that's exactly who it is. So I don't know if that answered your question, but that's what I mean by it.
Uh-huh. That was touching in on my question, which was usually creeds are developed in response to something. Am I right?
Well, that's a good question. I assume so.
Okay. Yeah. But and so I was wondering what the creed was in response to. I was tying into what Tim was saying is, was it in fact the divinity of Jesus that they were trying to protect? Or what was the...
Yeah. That's very complicated, and I don't know if I know the answer to it. I mean, what happened is that you had in Alexandria, you had a bishop, Alexander, and his sidekick Athanasius, who was a presbyter under him. And then you had a monk named Arius, who was teaching in a different church in Alexandria. And Arius was evidently a very charismatic kind of person, and people were responding to him, and he was developing a pretty big following. And here's the part I don't understand, is the followers of Arius and the followers of Alexander and Athanasius started rioting with each other. over theology, right? Oh, the good old days. And I don't understand that. I mean, probably there were socioeconomic rift between them. I mean, like the Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland a few years back. I mean, was that really over theology? I doubt it. You know, it's over social ostracism, socioeconomic gaps between them, and that kind of stuff. So there's probably a lot of factors that went into that. But whatever went into that, they rallied around the theology of Arius as over against the theology of Alexander and Athanasius, and started literally rioting in the streets over that. Well, somehow the energy of the rioting in the streets basically required bishops from other places in the empire to kind of take a stand and choose sides and that kind of stuff. So that's what was becoming so divisive in the empire that Constantine decided we got to get a handle on this. This is going to rip the empire apart if we don't get some unity here. So that's what it was responding to. But I don't have a book I read tried to kind of explain what was appealing to about the Arian view to the people who embraced Arius, and what was appealing to the other view to the people who embraced the other view. And I don't know that it convinced me. It still remains a mystery to me why anyone would riot in the streets over a theological doctrine.
Probably for the same reason that people would, you know, live in tents downtown for whatever reason.
Could be. Okay, so Jack, let me try and summarize this. You're making three contentions. One is this: if you could go back to 200 AD, this should have never happened as a doctrine. Mm-hmm. The reasoning that went into the formulation of this doctrine is faulty. That would be your second contention. And your third contention would be it should never, ever have been used as a test for what is an authentic believer.
Yes, about the second one. I don't know that I'm arguing that the reasoning, that there's anything faulty with the reasoning. If in fact, let's imagine that you could actually make sense out of the doctrine. I can't, but let's say that you could make sense out of the doctrine, and that it was true, that God really was triune in the way that the doctrine said. I think there are people who, in good faith, go to the Bible and do the best they can to understand the biblical text in the light of that being a given, that being true. And I don't think that they're being illogical or unreasonable in the way they do that. I just think it's unnecessary because it ain't true. I mean, there's really no reason why they have to make that a parameter on their interpretive judgment. But there have been some really intelligent, well-meaning people who have done good thinking under the constraint that whatever else is true, the Trinity is true. So I need to do all my interpretation on that assumption.
So you would say coalescing these three expressions of God into one is not necessarily a helpful project.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, I don't find it at all helpful. Yeah. John?
I'd like to go back for a second to that first chapter of the book of John.
Yes.
That one's always intrigued me.
Yeah.
You kind of touched on what you didn't think it was meaning when mm-hmm. it talked about logos and the word. I'd like to go back to what do you think it's talking about.
Okay.
Because it seems to, within a very short time there, describe whoever this logos is as being with God, being God, nothing being created without him being present. And then just a few verses down says that same logos became flesh and dwelt among us, which seems to me inescapable as a description of Christ.
Right.
So in what sense was the one who became flesh and dwelt among us present up there in all these ways with God the Father?
Okay. Yeah, see, the part of my view that would be clearly announced heretical would be the fact that, in my view, what do you have to start with? God. Whenever you have God, you have the Spirit of God, in the sense that the minute he creates the world, God can act within his creation. And when God acts within his creation, how does the Bible describe that? The Spirit of God did this, the Spirit of God did that, the Spirit of God did this other thing, the Spirit of God did something else. So God and the Spirit are easy. They just, God exists, his Spirit acts in God's creation. Okay, you have the creation of the world, you have God, and you have the creation. And then we go on a long time, a little longer, much longer, still longer still, until finally you have this child born in Bethlehem who was the human being that came into existence, that was created by God to be that human being in the line of David, destined rightful heir to the throne of David. And this human being was going to be the fulfillment of all that God had promised David. And what was that? That he would be that human being who, not just in name only, but in actuality, embodied the very sovereign reign, authority, power, and rule of Yahweh himself. That's the sense in which I think he is God. He's uniquely Yahweh. So the distinction between God and Jesus doesn't come into being until Jesus exists. The distinction between the Father and the Son is not a meaningful and valid distinction until the Son comes into being. And the Son is the one in the line of David that God created to be the fulfillment of all the promises he made to David. So that's the part of my view that would be, I think, officially declared heretical, is the fact that I'm denying the eternality of the Son. Okay, that being said, what's going on in John 1? I would argue that what logos means there, and logos is a very common word in Greek. It gets used in a lot of different ways, in a lot of different contexts, with a lot of different nuances. So it's not like this clearly and obviously technical term that has a very distinctive meaning that you would know immediately what it means, because you find the word everywhere. Hundreds of times in the New Testament. I have one here, Matthew 28:15. Now while they were on their way, some of the guard came into the city and reported to the chief priests all that had happened. And when they had assembled, this is after the resurrection, and when they had assembled with the elders and consulted together, they gave a large sum of money to the soldiers and said, "You are to say, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. And if this should come to the governor's ears, we will win him over and keep you out of trouble." And they took the money and did as they had been instructed. And this logos was widely spread among the Jews even up to this day. And the New American Standard translates logos story there. And this story was widely spread among the Jews even up to this day. The Greek word logos is used there. Well, that's the sense, and I think, in which John is using it in John 1. In the beginning was the story. And what does he have in mind there? The story that God wanted to create, the story that God wanted to tell, the story that God wanted to bring into existence. In the beginning, God had already devised, planned, and what's the word I'm looking for? Had already concocted this story. And so from before the time that there existed anything at all, God had this story in mind. So in the beginning was the story. The story was with God. And I don't know how to take that preposition. That you can go several different directions with that. But let me just go with the typical translation. The story was with God. And then the word order is, and God was the logos. Now I think he's equivocating. There's the logos that is the story, but then there's the logos that is the mind who devised the story. And I think in the end of that sentence, he's talking about the mind who devised the story. God was the author of the story. God was the deviser, the inventor of the story. And now he's equivocated. You know, he used it first to mean story and second to mean author. Now, if he's going to talk about this logos, he has to signal which of these logoses he means, right? So he repeats himself. Yeah, this was in the beginning with God. Okay, so you're talking about the story again. because those are the two claims he made with respect to the Logos in the first sense. Okay, so we're talking about the story. This story was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through it or in line with it, in keeping with it, and not anything which has ever come into being has come into being apart from it. In other words, all of cosmic reality has been scripted by God, and everything happens according to script. There isn't anything that is not on script. In other words, I think John is clearly stating his view as a divine determinist, where everything happens in keeping with exactly the will of God. In it, the story, right? In this story was life, and the life John has in mind is eternal life. I won't get into all the reasons for that, but I think it's pretty clear he means was eternal life for mankind. So what was included in this story was the possibility of life in the age to come for human beings. That was included in the story. So in it was life, and this life was the light of men. Knowledge and understanding, the most important piece of knowledge and understanding that any human being can ever have is how to attain life in the age to come. So in it was this life, and this life was the light of men. Now the light is shining in the darkness. The darkness did not extinguish it. So what's the light? The light is the knowledge of how to gain eternal life. And so now he goes into the prologue, the larger prologue of the letter, or of the gospel, to talk about how, and the light didn't extinguish it. Why? Because of this dude who was the true light, Jesus. John came announcing him, but he wasn't the true light. He only bore witness of the true light. The one who brought the true light of understanding how to attain life to mankind was the man Jesus. And who was Jesus? We find out several verses later. Jesus was the one who happened when the Logos, in the second sense, the Logos where he said God was the Logos, God was the author of the story, when the author became flesh and dwelt among us. That was Jesus. So I think that's absolutely true. I think that's as explicit a statement that any apostle ever makes about the exact identity of Jesus with the transcendent God himself. It was the one having become flesh, having become a human being.
I think you just maybe answered what I was going to ask. I was similar how you described a new believer becoming a Christian in college, reading the Bible for the first time, and the Trinity not jumping out to me at all, and asking a Bible study leader, you know, why can't Jesus just be? Why does Jesus have to be God? Why can't he just be the Messiah? And that, you know, ruffled her feathers, or definitely wanted me to believe in the concept of the Trinity. And so I guess that was my question, was why can't he just be the Messiah sent from God? Why does he have to be, as you were saying, uniquely Yahweh? Or I think that's the word you used. And I mean, but it's probably partly just what you had said coming from John. In that, is right. There anything else you would say about why he can't just be the Messiah?
Yeah, I think his deity is implicit in his messiahship, and the reason I say that is, and it took this is a recent realization on my part, but when you go back to the Davidic covenant, I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. Well, what is that concept? That's a concept that I think was probably already current in the ancient world when God used it with David. And what I would maintain is that concept was, how about if I be the God of the Jews and you be the human being who's the embodiment of my sovereign rule over the people, and my sovereign rule will be invested in you so that you will be me in reigning over the people. Well, you read the Psalms and you get all kinds of evidence that that's how David thinks of his reign. His reign is the reign of Yahweh. I mean, there's a psalm that starts, it's apparently a kind of a coronation psalm or something, a psalm that's being sung at the coronation of the king. And the first line is, Yahweh reigns. And I think what it's referring to is with the coming of this human being into the throne, this is Yahweh now in a position of authority over his people. And that's why you can have on a couple of occasions a psalm using the title God to refer to the human king. Why? Well, because if you are this king that God has promised, you are ruling as a proxy for God himself. In a sense, you might as well be God. So already implicit in the idea of the Messiah is that you will be the human being in whom God reigns with his reign over, ultimately, over creation. So I think they understood that, at least the if they had lost sight of that, I think the apostles are reintroduced to that idea so that, in the end, when Thomas sees the resurrected Jesus, puts his hands in the prints in his side and so on, says, "My Lord and my God." And I don't think that's, I mean, he's not thinking like a Greek there. He's not all of a sudden going, "Wow, I'll bet you have the divine essence, the divine hypostasis coexisting with the human hypostasis in a hypostatic union all together as one," right? I mean, there's no way that's what Thomas means. But what he can mean, which does make sense, is you're the Messiah, and if you're the Messiah, you're God. You're the human being who is the very proxy for God himself ruling with the rule of God. Well, that's in keeping with the whole Testament teaching and is much more plausible than thinking that he's jumped three centuries to the Nicene formulation. The only other thing I would say is that what is interesting is what did the apostles insist on throughout their teaching? Not that you must believe Jesus is God. You must believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, the Mashiach, the ones promised. So that's pretty interesting. That's where they put all their force. But what I'm saying is, but in their minds, that's not a whole lot different than saying Jesus is God with the right kind of concept of that. Okay, one more question.
Time for a comment?
Sure, comment.
Okay. A while back I read a rabbinical teaching from the Talmud around the time when John is following Jesus, and there were seven things that the Jews believed were in existence with God before the creation of the world, and that was heaven and hell and the throne of grace, the temple, repentance, and the sixth thing was the Torah, and the seventh thing was the name of the Messiah. And when I read that, I thought, wow, that sounds a lot like what maybe Jewish John might be referring to in the prologue.
Mm-hmm. The name of the Messiah,
yeah.
You mean? Yeah. Now, I'm not sure that's not the way I would read John 1, but that is how I would read Jesus' statement when, to make this as brief as possible, when the Pharisees say, "Who do you think you are? You think you're greater than Abraham?" He says, "Before Abraham was, I was." I think that's exactly what he meant there, is that I was in view from before the foundation of the earth. Do I think I'm greater than Abraham? You bet. Absolutely. I have been the foremost thing on God's mind from before the first time he created anything at all. I'm the center of this whole story. I'm the centermost, essentialmost element to this whole story. So, yeah, I'm more important than Abraham. Okay, need to let you go. Thank you.